Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money
at Menards. Today on Lightning Bugs.
There was a brilliant thing that happened. Let me tell you about with Peter Weir. I worked on a little telemovie of his, very little known, probably on YouTube somewhere, called The Plumber. And I'm in it, by the way. I walk out of an elevator. How about that? And Peter was trying to rehearse with his main cast, his two main characters, and he was going to be in the boardroom of this film corporation. And he was haranguing the producer saying, I need someone to videotape these rehearsals so I can look at them. And this is way back in the 70s, you know, where video cameras were like the size of a Cadillac. And the producer was saying what producers always say, which is like, we don't have the money. I haven't got the money to do it. And then Peter looked over and said, well, what about Scott? Because I was already on the crew, you know. So the producer looks at me and says, oh, well, there's always Scott.
Yeah, right.
He said, well, he can do it, you know. So there I was for 3 days in a boardroom with Peter Weir and his two main cast and videotaping the rehearsals. And so, you know, I was privy to his process of direction, how he spoke to the actors, you know. And as we went on, and he would look at playback of stuff that I was doing, he said, you're really getting into this, aren't you? Because I was looking for good angles and, you know, finding nice two shots and things like that. So, you know, to that extent, that was a form of mentorship by example, if you like.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. Happy Thursday. If you're here, you've made it to another episode of Lightning Bugs, Conversations with me, Ben Folds. Today, my guest is Scott Hicks. He's an internationally acclaimed film director, producer, screenwriter. He's directed blockbuster films like Shine, Snow Falling on Cedars, beautiful film, Hearts in Atlantis, and The Lucky One. Scott is the man behind many successful documentaries, series, and massive commercial campaigns. He's also an accomplished photographer. He's also a really good winemaker and grape grower. We had a really insightful chat, and I think you'll dig it. My first question to you, to make this super formal and interview-like, is your mentors. When you were coming up,
right?
Does anyone pop up in your mind, like it, in any discipline? It doesn't have to be in film. It could be, you know, you're a great basketball player too, I'm sure. So, tell me about your mentors and the importance of that.
Well, I think thinking about it, what happened was when I started working on the crews of other people's films, you know, which is where I began. I was lucky enough to work for a couple of first class directors in Peter Weir, Bruce Beresford.
Oh, and, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and you know, the thing was that I had the incredible luxury of being able to watch those guys working. They weren't mentors in the sense that there was a conscientious sort of, you know, ushering me into something, but they definitely, there was a brilliant thing that happened. Let me tell you about with Peter Weir. I worked on a little telemovie of his, very little known, probably on YouTube somewhere, called The Plumber. And I'm in it, by the way. I walk out of an elevator. How about that? And Peter was trying to rehearse with his main cast, his two main characters, and he was going to be in the boardroom of this film corporation. And he was haranguing the producer saying, I need someone to videotape these rehearsals so I can look at them. And this is way back in the 70s, you know, where video cameras were like the size of a Cadillac. And the producer was saying what producers always say, which is like, we don't have the money. I haven't got the money to do it. And then Peter looked over and said, well, what about Scott? And the producer,
do you have money? He's got money.
Because I was already on the crew, you know. So the producer looks at me and says, oh, well, there's always Scott.
Yeah, right.
He said, well, he can do it, you know. So there I was for 3 days in a boardroom with Peter Weir and his two main cast and videotaping the rehearsals. And so, you know, I was privy to his process of direction, how he spoke to the actors, you know. And as we went on, and he would look at playback of stuff that I was doing, he said, "You're really getting into this, aren't you?" Because I was looking for good angles and, you know, finding nice two shots and things like that. So, you know, to that extent, that was a form of mentorship by example, if you like.
I mean, you can feel by osmosis when you're getting it right and wrong when someone that is that great, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, with Beresford, I worked on a couple of films of his, and I ended up as first assistant director on one of them. The last film he made in Australia before going to do Tender Mercies in America, and I can remember making some naive suggestion to him about which was practically going to be better for me because it would mean we would finish sooner, and he just said, "No, that's not going to work," you know. And so, yeah, there was you learned by the positive and the negative.
But how did you get there in the first place? Like you're on the set working on Peter Weir's serious master of the craft. How did you end up there?
There is a whole chain of events, if you like. I mean, I had gone to university. I'd stumbled by accident into the drama course, thinking it would be an easy kind of read a few plays and the rest of it. There was a little topic in that called filmmaking, which kind of took over my whole university degree and literally to the exclusion of everything else. And I came out of university, you know, really pumped up, thinking, here I am, I've written, produced, directed, you know, these movies. But of course, you're out in the real world. And but at the same time, the equivalent of the governor of the state of South Australia, who was the premier, Don Dunstan, decided that we would have this thing called a film corporation. And nobody knew what a film corporation was. But the point was, he was going to make some money available to attract talent into Adelaide and into South Australia. So Peter Weir, who was then this premier filmmaker in the country, came to live in Adelaide, and he made three films here.
Which ones were those?
Well, Picnic at Hanging Rock was the most famous, but he had made that sort of prior to, I think it did have this film corporation money in, I think. He made The Plumber, the little telly movie. He made The Last Wave, which was an astonishing film with Richard Chamberlain and David Gulpilil and others. And also from South Australia, he made Gallipoli. So there were actually four films that were all sort of connected to being made here. And, you know, by dint of just sheer persistence, I managed to get on the crew of The Plumber. And I was, I don't know, I forget what I was, third assistant director.
And how old were you then?
How old? I was, I would have been 22, something like that, 20, you know.
Yeah,
third assistant director means you make the coffee and you clean up the vomit after dailies. You know, so awesome. That was...
It's what you ought to be doing when you're 22 years
exactly.
old.
Exactly. Well, it does teach you a few things, like a certain degree of humility. And then I got a job on The Last Wave, where I seconded to the art department, you know, the people who do the sets and the design. And so I was sort of an assistant. And then they said to me, "Now we need a night watchman on the set," because they were borrowing. They actually borrowed some masterpieces from the South Australian Art Gallery that were hanging on the walls of the set of this house. And insurance, you know, required that somebody had to be living there 24 hours. So I was in the art department during the day, and at night I was a night watchman for these masterpieces, which I had it all worked out in my mind. You know, like I was in this little upstairs room, locked into my room. I thought, if anybody breaks in, I'm just going to say the really good ones are on the stairs, right? That was the extent of my involvement. But again, it just gave me a front row seat into what Peter Weir was doing.
Now, I've heard that Peter Weir loves or loved, and maybe this is just something I cooked up, but did he love to play music on the set while filming? Isn't music a big part of Peter Weir, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. He walked around playing, you know, Tangerine Dream or David Bowie and setting a mood and creating an atmosphere, which is really paramount sort of element of his filmmaking is the ability to do that. He would even play it during takes, you know, where the sound...
That's what I'd heard, yeah, that he's playing it while you guys are filming.
Well, it was crazy because, I mean, the sound recordists are going mad, you know, like, because, of course, it would all have to be
that shit out
later,
of
you know. But then he used it as a mood creator in many different ways. I mean, the camera operator on that film was John Seale, who's now the, you know, Academy Award-winning DP for, God, what was it? One of Lord of the Rings or something. I don't know. He was the camera operator. He was the premier operator in the country. And they were setting up to do this track in onto Richard Chamberlain and Olivia Hamnett, who were the couple in the movie. And Peter said, look, I just want the feel of when it's going to happen. And John said, look, but Peter, when do you want me to actually start the move, you know? And Peter said, it's okay, John, you'll feel it. Roll camera, you know, and then everything sort of happens. And the camera pushes in, and then we cut. And those days, we didn't have any video playback or anything. You know, you had to really trust the operator of the camera.
Yeah.
And Peter said, how was it? And John said, I felt it, you know. So he had this extraordinary way of creating an atmosphere on set that all fed into the film that he was making. So it was fabulous to watch, you know.
Hi, Mr. Ben. This is Steph from Omaha, Nebraska. And I've got a question for you about creativity. I'm a college instructor, and one of the courses I teach is about the psychology of learning. And most people sort of think of learning and creativity as being separate processes.
Mm.
But we actually have a fair amount of evidence showing how previous learning experiences can influence creativity in both humans and even in other animals like chimps and even pigeons. My question for you is, how do you think your past learning experiences influence your creativity today? For example, how do you think the time you spent learning scales or how to play other people's work or even learning multiple instruments influences you when you sit down to create a new piece of music today? And full disclosure, I'm hoping to share your answer with my students so they can see a firsthand account of how learning and creativity interact in a contemporary working artist. Thank you.
Oh, man. Amazing thoughts and questions. You know more than I do. I'll sort of just as someone, someone who makes stuff, I'll just respond to it and in very unqualified language. I think that creativity has so much to do with problem solving. To me, the problem solving can also be an awesome distraction. You know, if I'm trying to solve the problem of how to fit a certain number of lyrics into a very, short line with no syllable real estate, and I'm just trying to work that out, the problem solving takes me into another state of mind, which I find very creative. I feel as though I am collaborating with my circumstances at that point, and I'm not alone. I think that your experiences or my experiences generally serve as limitations, and I think that's good. You know, it's like it gives you a palette. You've done this worked. You've done this, this worked. You've done this worked. I think that John Batiste, when he was on my podcast, was very articulate and even poetic about what he described as the mundane being the things that were discovered before him. So he's not going in to discover these things. He's going in with the experience of having learned, of having, you know, experience with something and just using them as boring parts. Yeah, they were interesting when they were created either by someone else or by him earlier. But now the mundane, and this might get into scales, is something that becomes, because it's part of your palette and it's a tool, it not only serves as a limitation, because say you know three scales. Well, you use those three scales. That limits you. And then you have to problem solve your way into it. So I think even though it might seem like detours and distractions, creativity weaves itself into into your life. And you may be driving somewhere and realize there's a detour sign, and you suddenly have to figure out how to get across to the other side of town. And you're going to have a different set of experiences, and you're going to improvise and react to them. That's why I think creativity doesn't happen in a vacuum. So all these things to me are vacuums. One thing I would also say about learning and creativity, especially when it comes to music, is my experience is that when you learn something, you say you learn a scale or you learn some music theory or you learn some voice leading, some harmony, something, a technique, I think we all tend to suck for a while as we absorb it because we're so overly focused on it. And so it gives vocabulary, technique, proficiency a bad name sometimes because people are like, look, it made me worse. Look, I know too much now. Now I'm like, you know, I'm making sterile know-it-all records. I want to be more like Bob Dylan. Really the way I feel about that and what I like to tell kids is be patient. Learn a thing, accept that you'll suck for a while. And when you're done with that and it fades into the background, or perhaps it fades into something that just kind of exists as a faint, you know, memory in your frontal lobe somewhere where you don't know why you like that. You just like it, or you don't know how you're using that. You're just using it, or you're running down a set of steps. And if you thought about it too much, you'd fall down the steps, but you don't think about it anymore. You just run down steps. And to me, that scales and things that are tools that help you and also serve as limitations. Those are my scattered thoughts. And now I think you should take that step and actually be a professional and tell me what I meant to say. Thanks for your question. Now, given that we can see things at a drop of a hat, that we can do things so efficiently, is there anything that you miss when you tell that Peter Weir story and everyone's feeling it and no one's getting to see it? What are your feelings about that and how to retain that with our efficiency now?
Look, I don't hanker after that at all. I mean, I love the flexibility. I love everything that you can do with technology, the whole digital world. Mm. It's brilliant. But I'm really glad that I experienced the transition and that I came from the day when, you know, you had a little Bolex camera, which you had to wind up like clockwork. You had 100 feet of film that was like 3 minutes. So you were very, very sparing in your shooting. And you,
crazy.
You paid a lot of attention to when the camera was off or on. And, you know, and then the having to take something from that part of it right through to editing, you know, editing your work print on a flatbed and actually gluing pieces of film together and looking through separate frames to see, you know, all of that, I think it has sort of gone, obviously.
Aside from it being a good old days, the glory days story, why are you glad that you had that experience?
I think,
and what, how can kids now get that, or do they need it?
Well, I think one of the potential drawbacks of being able to shoot the shit out of absolutely everything all the time. In fact, these days, some people just leave the camera rolling without ever bothering to turn it off. And of course, what they forget is that they're amassing vast amounts of data that somebody has to process and record and
pay me later.
And then an editor's got to view it all, you know, and it's just a camera's been sitting on a table for 45 minutes. I mean, it's there's a kind of laissez-faire thing now, which you know, I like the fact that you had to be very disciplined. And then in making low-budget films, it taught you how to you know, make the best of every bit that you had, making then a transition to where in a low-budget Australian film, the film stock was a major cost element. Go to Hollywood, make a movie, nobody cares. You shoot 500,000 feet, you know, it's the least expensive thing. The most expensive thing is the people in front of the camera, you know. So I just feel that having had that sort of discipline was a good way to begin. But I sure wouldn't want to go back there.
And I'm glad that I went through that, but I have a hard time articulating why I'm glad, because I'm not dead sure it's doing me any good. And I see brilliant kids now, but I'm wondering what we can pass to them in terms of so they don't have to go through what we did, but still get something out of it.
The other thing is that at the other end of the business, I mean, where a film really gets made, ultimately sculpted, is in the edit, in the editing room, and all those weeks and months that you spend with your editors and, you know, fashioning the whole, actually finding the film is a big part of it to me. And that's not just in documentary, which is obviously in documentary, you know, you shoot everything that moves or doesn't move, and you never know what you're going to use. And you look for the film in the edit room.
Two people might quit the quartet in the middle of the...
You never know. People might get divorced.
Never know what's going to
happen. In front of your eyes. And so, you know, it's a thing. And that's a documentary, you know, get sort of energized by that. But yeah. It's the same thing with a scripted film. I mean, even a film, you know, like Shine, which it was something where a major structural element of the film I had to find in the editing room when there was no possibility of reshooting anything.
Oh.
But there was a whole strand of that film that was just not working. The performances were flat and terrible. And I just said, look, just get rid of them. I never want to see them again. And the editor said to me, yeah, but what are we going to do? And I said, I don't know. What I do know is there's not going to be 1 second of bad performance in this film. So we get rid of this and then we'll see what we've got. And she said, well, that's fine, but it happens to be that time frame is the beginning, the middle, and the end of the film.
So basically, everything's gone except for a couple of
so
scenes.
You know, wow. And that's what had to happen.
Can I ask you what the what that thread was and how you actually achieved that?
I hope Jeffrey Rush isn't watching. Anyway, he's come a long way since then. But that was pretty much it was his first major role in a movie. You know. He was in his 40s. He was a renowned theater actor. It had been a major stumbling block putting him into the movie to get the film financed with someone who was not known in film. We went to London and started shooting because I was terrified that John Gielgud would drop dead before we got there. And anyway, he didn't travel, so he wasn't coming to Australia. And we started shooting, and Jeffrey had not found the character of David. I mean, Jeffrey is a brilliant actor, but he had not located David in his own brain, and he was sort of very passive in front of the lens. And I kept saying to him, Jeffrey, you know, you have to do something. He said, No, I've been told the camera will find me. I said, Jeffrey, you could do something, you know, anything. So, and he wrote home to his wife, which he told me later, saying, I'm in this movie. I think it's called Shite, you know. And it was horrible. It was just horrible. Jeffrey's someone who just loves material to pore over and research, and you know, he really flutters over it all and absorbs an enormous amount. Noah doesn't want anyone fucking with the inside of his head, you know, as an actor. So he needs a different set of tools to work with as an actor. But the thing was, we came back to Australia. We had 3 weeks before we continued shooting, and I plied Jeffrey with all this material, and he did a huge amount of work. And day one in Australia, bang, it was brilliant. He'd found the character, and he'd said to me, once I found him, it'll never go away. I know where he is in my brain, you know. And it was quite right. It was like a dream after that.
How about that? So you lost everything that was before that. So stuff that was shot of him in England was what wasn't
absolutely
working.
We just that was the material. It was flat, and the film would go through these fabulous things, and then suddenly hit a flat spot again. You know, and so I did what you have to do, which is throw stuff away. You can't be precious about anything.
Yeah,
and
right.
You know, so that was, you know, but you know, circling back to that thing of the old technology versus the new.
Yeah.
One of the drawbacks of the new digital world is I think you have less time to contemplate, to reflect.
Right.
I
totally agree.
Now, because you can change everything, change it again. No, get rid of that. Three different cuts in a day.
No, it drives me at the motherfucking wall.
Nobody knows what's going on, you know.
in the recording studio, it's rewind.
Right.
If you're going to start another take, you got to wait for the guy to rewind the take.
Right.
And I never realized how much of a reset that was for me until digital started. And it was like, we're going to do another take. What's going on? Like, I needed a second to process it. And it occurs to me, too, that if you can't shoot everything in the world, it sounds like you were left with a scary, scant amount of footage with which to make a movie, which wouldn't have been a problem now. You would have had lots of extra shit,
yes,
but maybe that wouldn't have been appropriate. So how did you, had you cut so much that it was
problem? We still had enough to deal with. I mean, just by comparison, you know, Shine, I think we shot 100-something thousand feet of film. Snow Falling on Cedars, we shot 500,000. And that's partly of the incredible nature of the DP on Snow Falling. But
it was a beautiful movie. I'm so glad I saw that in a good theater. That was just
it was a
massive,
sublime experience and so on. But the thing was that that thing of contemplation is just what editing is about. Mm. And the editor who did Shine, and she'd done many things with me, she insisted on having a couch in her edit suite so she could lie down and have a rest after lunch, you know. And I was put in mind of, it was Jean Cocteau who used to hang a sign on his door saying the poet works while he had a sleep in the afternoon, because
he's working,
you know, because it's totally contemplation, you know, contemplation and consideration of what you've done. And the ability to.
I wonder how you fabricate that in an era where it's not enforced on you. You know, if people coming along now are going to learn something from. I mean, I know as a music artist, we were always looking back to Jimi Hendrix or the Beatles or before that Chuck Berry or something, and trying to figure out how they got the magic of that. Of course, in my era, the technology was one of the things that was possibly already in the way, if you wanted to sort of find that again, because they had to work harder to get it. But I wonder what kids or people coming along now can be taught or think about to at least synthetically give them that bit of processing and contemplation that you enjoyed in the making of your early films.
I don't know. I mean, because one of the problems I suspect is that two producers who are trying to make something, you know, really good for next to nothing in some cases, you know, and even those who have got more resources, always, you know, everybody likes to find the most efficient way to make something. Mm-hmm. People who think along those lines would find it very hard to understand if someone said, you know what, I think we should just sit on this cut for a day or so while we figure out a couple of other things. And they go, why not do it now? You know, because you can, 5 clicks of a button and it's done. But, you know, you go back, you circle back to Coppola editing Apocalypse Now, you know, and he's editing with a fleet of editors and all the rest of it is all on 35mm film. And he gets a brilliant idea about a restructuring, flies into the edit room, starts everybody recutting, move this to here. And you're talking about physical strips of film, you know, hanging from little pegs on a basket. And people are hunting out these pieces and sticking them back together in another order. And then he gets it to a point where he goes, it's not working. The idea that he had didn't bear out. So now they have to reconstruct what they had before.
Yeah.
And there is no physical record of it. You know, I mean,
right.
Can you imagine?
There was a pair of producers, and they had produced Radiohead, and they're from Boston. And I was sort of interviewing them to do one of my albums. I wanted to do it in Adelaide, and they didn't want to come to Adelaide. And that's another thing I want to talk to you about. But they didn't want to come there and live, so we didn't do it. But what they said was so uncool for the era and so proper to me and right, which was, we choose artists when we can understand what their calling card is. Hmm. What is entertaining, what's interesting, what's going to grab someone's attention. They had produced Radiohead, and they said, listen, Songs are fine. The experimenting is fine. It's Tom's voice. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's talent, and he's sharing talent. That's all we care about. So we're going to produce that. We're going to record that. And it made me listen to people in that way. I would begin to listen to people like, what's their calling card? Like, sometimes it's visual. You know, maybe Madonna or something, or it could be like Mark Knopfler from the same era. Guitar. He can sing fine. But you really go, okay, what's his calling card? That's what it is. For me, it would be, you know, piano. Like I could play a gig and sing, but that's the thing. What do you think for you is in your career, what's your calling card in making movies? What's the thing that you can't do without that you can do?
I'm not sure if this is quite right, but I think it's a way of seeing. And by that, I mean, you know, just folding back on that thing of taking stills of my friends and so on, I think it actually, through the still photography, I actually taught myself more about the image and about focus and about light, the value of light. I've begun to learn how to read light. I didn't know how to make it. That was up to a DP or to do, but I knew what I liked, and I knew how to...
The story of the light.
And it was about telling stories, and I would take successions of photographs from different angles, and in a way I was covering a scene without knowing it. And so I learned much more out of that sort of self-taught process, really akin to what you were saying, than I did from all the instruction I had from anybody in the university course, quite honestly. And I think that way of seeing, look, over a long period of time of trying to get films made and all the rest of it, but there were people who noticed, looking at even my clumsiest early sort of expressions, that there was a way I used the camera that was interesting. And so I think that was a starting point for it. And by the time I started to make films that really meant something, I was applying all of those elements to it. And to the frame.
So even if you've got a DP that's working for you, they're still your eyes. I mean, you're having to communicate to them.
Absolutely. I found that. In fact, I have a little issue with the title director of photography, in the sense that I think a lot of people don't actually earn that. They're lighting camera people. Because I've certainly found that I directed the photography in almost all of my films up until Snow Falling on Cedars, where the sainted Bob Richardson was my DP, and he was the director of photography. There was no question. What he added to my process was enormous. And it liberated me, because I could just focus on my actors and the staging of the scene and not worry about, I just knew the camera was going to be brilliant. I mean, the man's a genius.
We place so much value, and I think a lot of creative people do a job for money that they enjoy fine, and then we go home and do something completely different. Because for me, it was like, you know, touring business. I get home, I would photograph and print.
Right.
I got up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning to print, and then I would do that until about noon, and then I would go into the studio, and that was almost my secondary. It was like my day job was playing music. Now, a lot of people trying to make it in music would find that odd, but I think I like to set put people's minds at ease who are doing something in their life to realize that someone like you, for instance, might get as much pleasure out of creating a vineyard as you would creating something that was film or a photograph or other things. You wouldn't be as famous for it. But I don't know. I think we have it out of whack. When someone becomes popular for something, that so outweighs everything.
Yeah.
That I feel like people feel badly about themselves for making their art at night while they sell insurance in the day, which is actually what Charles Ives did. Charles Ives, the composer, was an insurance salesman.
God. Yeah. Well, I just when you were talking then, I thought, yeah, I wonder if part of it was a function of age. I mean, I was 43 when Shine sort of exploded.
Right.
If I was 25, it would have been a different set of choices.
Right.
I think the point was, I had a life, and I had a family, and
right.
I'd spent an enormous amount of time away from them, because that's what filmmaking sort of demands. It's kind of like being on tour, I guess, except you're more or less in one place. But you're a long way away, and that was full of challenge and difficulty. But I think being the age I was, I thought, well, I'm not going to uproot myself and relocate there. If people want me, they can find me, talk to me. I had really good agents, attorneys, and all that.
That's strong.
And things did happen, and when I sort of wanted them to.
Well, I think it makes you more exotic in a way. I mean, I think it's a cool thing to not be just dying to do it all the time, because at the same time, when just to be clear for anyone who wouldn't be familiar with your style of working while you're working, you're relentless when you're working on something. Focused. It's kind of like there's two kind of people when they're working, and they're either focused beyond anything or they're sort of part-timing it. And just to be clear, in case someone's listening thinking, he just kind of wants to hang out at the vineyard. This man, when he starts working, you need to get out of his way, because you're going to get it done. Yeah. I think it's awesome.
Well, that's it. I was fascinated by Philip Glass, was someone, this huge sort of disciplinarian, self-disciplinarian. Has a process now where, he's up sort of meditating at 3 a.m. And then he'll sit down at the piano. When I was, shooting with him, he had two very young kids, under 5. And he would spend time with them, and then there would be breakfast and so on. But at 9 o'clock, he would sit at the piano. And he said that he'd done this from the earliest days when he wanted to compose. He said, I just made myself sit at the piano, even if there wasn't an idea in my head. I had to be there and I had to do something.
Yeah.
And he said, sooner or later, things happen, and so he found a way. And I actually said to him, well, but what happens if you wake up at midnight, with a brilliant sort of riff going through your head or whatever? He said, well, I try to ignore it. I just say, just go away. Yeah. I'm not ready for you. And he said, and I'll get up in the morning and hope, if I can remember it, it was good, and I'll do it. And he said, very occasionally I'll go, oh, all right, But the point was he was training the muse to come to him when he required her.
Yeah, because.
And not out of hours,
Yeah, so, because she's inconsiderate. Amazing. She comes as you're at a traffic light or you're in bed or something. Right. It's never when you want.
Exactly.
He said something in your film that did change. It gave me a really big tool. And that was, and I've said it over and over again, I hope I'm getting it right, that he almost waits as if he's in mist for point of a ship to come through. And that's all he knows. It's like, there's the point. And he's going to report. He didn't say this, but he's going to report on that point. There it is. That's the point of it. What's next? Fuck if I know. It could be like 8 miles long. It could just be a little point and that's it. But he's going to, and when you listen to his music, that is a quality that it has, which is, we're here. It's happening. If you put down the needle on a Phil Glass record, you'll hear a thing that you think is never changing. But then if you pick it up and go later, it's developed amazingly. Yes. Anyone that doesn't think he has composition chops out of fucking mind. Like, he's developed it. He just did it his way. But to me, his image of waiting. And it sits with me the same way as my engineer told me years ago that his teacher told him that the most valuable thing you can do sometimes is to sit on your hands.
Huh.
You think you should do something.
Right. Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah.
Sit on your hands and let it happen. And it seems like Philip Glass does that.
It's really resonant with him, I think, because the other image he had, he said, look, it's like an underground river. You know that it's there, but you don't know exactly where, and you certainly don't know where it's going. And you have to align yourself with it. But if you look too hard, you won't find it.
No.
So, I mean, it's like, oh, my God. So, and because his other thing, again, moving through fog, he talks about, so it's like being in a field of fog in the early morning, and you can't see beyond, and you move through, and there's a shape, and oh, it's a tree, you know, and then you can pass that, and there's another thing, like, oh my God, it's a fence post, and there's wires also, you know. So he said, so you follow that instinct, and that is the underground river in a sense. And that, so again, it comes to contemplation, you know, there's a real sense of if you look too hard,
yes,
you won't find it.
Well, John Lennon had a good analogy for it. I read in an interview once. It might have been his last interview. It might have been that Rolling Stone interview. But he was saying that, I guess his upbringing was such that he saw a lot of cockroaches. It's like if you turn the lights on looking for the cockroaches, they all scurry to the edges. You won't see them. But your job is to turn on the light to try to find them. So it's a difficult thing to chase. For him, it was the simple idea.
Yeah.
And he wanted to be able to, like a song like Imagine probably did it. That's probably what he was going for in general, I think. That when you're searching for that elusive thing that he was searching for, he go, I want to see it. Bam, turn the light on. They all scurry for the, for the corners. And that's what's so awful about being in the creative business is that all the things that turn the lights on, your technique, your awareness, just being lucid, are also the things that can so scare off cockroaches.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you go searching and trying to yank the ship out of the out of the fog or yank it out of the fog, it's not going to happen. And I guess it goes back in a way to the contemplate the complaint.
It's easy for you to say.
I can't say it. I'm American. The complaining time.
That one, yeah.
Yeah, you know what the fuck I'm talking about. That time that you get an analog or that you got back in the day that's difficult to find now. I think sitting on your hands and waiting for the ship to come through is not easy to do with our current tools.
I'll just show you this book, which I guess you can see. It's by David Lynch. And it was...
Yeah.
Actually, it was Daniel Johns who turned me onto this, which is an amazing little thing because it speaks to the whole sort of area that we're talking about now. But it's a book about the whole process of divining ideas, and you know, most pages have got four lines on them, you know, or sometimes it goes for a page and a half, maybe, but. It's almost like it was another form of contemplation that I used for a while after Dan showed me this book. It was every morning I would sort of, at random, like this morning I opened it thinking of this conversation we were going to have, and it opened at this page called Desire. And can I read it? It's just a few lines. Okay, so Desire. Desire for an idea is like bait. When you're fishing, you have to have patience. You bait your hook and then you wait. The desire is the bait that pulls those fish in, those ideas. The beautiful thing is that when you catch one fish that you love, even if it's a little fish, a fragment of an idea, that fish will draw in another fish and they'll hook onto it. Then you're on your way. Soon there are more and more and more fragments and the whole thing emerges. But it starts with desire. Here ends the lesson, you know, and it's like, read that, wake up in the morning, open this book at random, and just read what is on that page. And it just puts you into a mindset.
Which, what's the name of the book again?
It's called
everyone?
Catching the Big Fish. And if David Lynch happens to listen to this, I want 5% of all Amazon sales that you're now going to get.
And if someone buys it,
I have to send half of that to Daniel Johns because he turned me on to it. So, you know.
As we get to the end of this, one of the things I want, I like everyone to do is, I don't know if they prepped you about this. It's called New Week's Resolution. It's just,
well, I think I've just given you mine.
That's it. Okay.
That's it.
So what you want is for everyone watching to buy that book and then read part of it.
Well, it's that book or something. I mean, I've been meaning to read that thing for a long time, whatever. Give yourself permission to just have it and make it the first thing you do in the morning. Mm. Just to pay attention to that book, read that page, read that chapter, whatever it might be. It may even take a few minutes, may take half an hour. Mm. But while your mind is clear and before any other inputs come in.
So as an exercise for people who value creativity and are trying to foster it, you are saying to take a book and make a certain amount of time when you wake up. I mean, a lot of people wake up and it's just like, holy shit, I got to get my kids up and get to school and do all the things. How would you amend this to make it for your average person so that it's something achievable for a week?
It does mean probably if you wake to your alarm, you know, you've got to maybe give yourself half an hour earlier. But I mean, I'll make myself a short black or a short, you know, like a long macchiato coffee, you know, to wake my mind up. But I avoid inputs. Email, radio, television. I get back into bed, you know, where it's warm, or sit somewhere where you're comfortable, and just read. In other words, it's giving yourself permission, in a sense, to do nothing.
Right.
But you are doing something. You're feeding your mind with something.
Yeah.
You know? And if you can combine that with a coffee and a quick bike ride afterwards.
Yeah. But see, what I like about your New Week's resolution is that it's easy enough. This is like songwriting. It's easy enough to say you should not pay as much attention to your phone, or you should get off telecoms, or that keeps you not in the present. You need to be mindful. But having a solution or having a way to start your day that ensures that you don't do that makes sense. So I dig that. I mean, I would say 15 minutes for anyone that's got kids, you know, just take the 15 minutes, take a deep breath, don't read the stuff, don't worry about anything. And just pick up a beautiful book and read it from the middle.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that. That's cool. All right. Well, unless you've got something you want to add to that, I think it's got loads of gold for people who make stuff. And
well, you made it fun, and to have a conversation with you was the objective of this thing, and it's really worked out. I felt stimulated by what you're saying, so I think that's really important.
Well, you and I shoot the shit a lot.
kind of works.
We just go.
If you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.